Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Too big to fail. Moral hazard. Systemic risk. In the past year, Ben Bernanke has seen it all. And he figures he's done just about everything he can all by himself. So today, he told Congress to get to it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is great to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 23rd of October. The Federal Reserve Bank of Boston adjourned to Cape Cod for a conference today. They invited the big boss along to share his thoughts, and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke had plenty of them. He said it's time for Congress to approve regulatory reforms, rather, that will prevent another financial crisis. He said there needs to be somebody with an eye on the risks to the entire financial system, a systemic risk regulator who can see threats in all parts of the economy, from housing to insurance to hedge funds. Who might that regulator be? Well, Bernanke has just the guy, of course. Him. All right, the whole Fed, actually. But our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports that Mr. Bernanke is going to have to change some minds in Congress.
Bernanke said the Fed is already keeping an eye on the horizon for looming risks to the financial system, but he says he needs more authority.
Regulators and supervisors can do a great deal, but comprehensive financial reform requires action by Congress.
In Congress, reformers want to give power to a council of regulators to rein in excessive risk-taking by all sorts of financial firms, from banks to insurance companies. One idea is to put that council under the direction of the Fed. Today, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, opposed that idea, and the Milken Institute's James Barth agrees.
I'm not so sure that the Federal Reserve should have all the powers to deal with all financial sector type issues. The Federal Reserve didn't particularly distinguish itself with respect to dealing with the most recent crisis.
Barth says the Fed will be preoccupied with interest rates, inflation, and unemployment. And Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute says the Fed itself can create economic risks, for example, when it gets interest rates wrong.
And so to give to the Fed the authority to find systemic risk at the same time that the Fed is actually capable of creating systemic risk would seem to me to be a very silly idea.
Wallison says the Fed has no monopoly on the expertise to become a risk regulator. For example, he says it can be found just as easily in the Treasury Department. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Not that we needed a whole lot of reminding at this point, but just in case, Microsoft brought it to everyone's attention again today. In a recovering economy, somehow even down is up. The software maker announced this morning profits fell 18% in the latest quarter. Its stock then hit a 16-month high. You can credit those three little words we've been talking about all week on the program. Things were better than expected. In fact, they're looking pretty darn good. And not just at Microsoft either. Tech in general is on a tear, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Looking back, Microsoft sold a lot of Xbox game consoles, and recovering PC sales helped boost its other businesses. Looking forward, there's lots of interest in the new Windows 7 operating system.
They sold $1.5 billion worth of Windows 7 to consumers, and that was, about 20% above estimates.
Equity analyst Catherine Egbert at Jefferies & Company says Microsoft is creating buzz again.
700 people lined up yesterday in Phoenix, Arizona to get into the first Microsoft retail store, and so there seemed to be a good amount of interest.
Interest in buying software and PCs among consumers who've been reluctant to spend on anything. But Egbert's quick to point out the bigger trend here for Microsoft and its peers is the flight to online shopping, which is why companies like Amazon, which hit a record high today, are leading this charge.
Clearly, people are buying from Amazon, and in order to do that, you need a PC. The Apple numbers the other day, they did well selling Macs. I think there's a case to be made for surfing the Internet being a cheap form of entertainment.
It's also a cheap way to buy stuff, says IDC analyst Karsten Weide.
The market is just much more transparent. In other words, I can compare prices much more readily than I could offline.
So are we looking at another tech bubble?
We again have sort of a wave of hype. But what is true is that the internet will change everything. We really only see the beginning of it.
So this time around, the hype may just be real. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Microsoft shares faded a bit during the day, but they still gained more than 5%. The rest of the market just plain faded. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so let's see. Home prices are lower than they've been in years. A 30-year fixed-rate mortgage can be had for about 5%. And if you are new to the wonderful world of real estate, the government will let you take $8,000 off your taxes this year. So perhaps the figure that came in from the National Association of Realtors this morning should not have been the surprise it was, that sales of existing homes jumped 9.4% last month. There really isn't much doubt about those numbers, but there is some disagreement over whether that first-time homebuyer tax credit is completely responsible. It's set to expire on November 30th, and politicians eager for an economic turnaround are asking this question today. Should the credit be extended? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Talk to the National Association of Realtors, and they'll tell you housing sales would have been down this year without the first-time homebuyer tax credit. Walter Maloney is the group's spokesman.
With the credit this year, we are projecting existing home sales will rise 1.5%. Not a big gain, but without the tax credit, sales would drop about 6%.
Congress is now deciding whether to extend the tax credit for another 4 to 6 months. Not surprisingly, the National Association of Realtors is lobbying for a yes vote. Zach Pandel wants Congress to vote no. He's an economist at Nomura Securities. He says our money is better spent through efforts by the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low. That helps all home buyers.
For the first-time home buyer tax credit, I think you have to wonder whether that's the most bang for the buck. There are other things that are supporting home demand, like low prices and low mortgage rates.
And Pandel says first-time homebuyers only accounted for about 31% of home sales last month. The realtors say it was more like 41%. Guy Sakala is publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. He says regardless of how you measure first-time buyers, it's important to get them into the market. And the tax credit does that.
If I wanted to buy a house, it was just a question of when. This is pushing me to do it.
Sakala says bargain basement prices for a new basement will eventually be enough to boost sales. He says extend the tax credit once, but if the realtors lobby for more extensions next year, Congress should just say no. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Just one day after he cut salaries for big breadwinners at companies that got the most bailout help from the government, Kenneth Feinberg said today in a speech he could have done more had he wanted. Feinberg pointed out that his job as the government's pay watchdog does indeed give him the authority to take back compensation from executives at any company that got bailout money, not just the biggies. He just doesn't see the need to do that right now. Feinberg's announcement about executive pay yesterday and the Federal Reserve's new rules limiting compensation for lower-level traders and brokers is where we begin our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond this Friday. Here to help are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Mike Mandel, the chief economist at Business Week. Good to talk to you both again.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here, Kai.
Are we safer now, Mike, than we were before these pay announcements were made?
Are we safer now?
Isn't that the whole point of this thing, right?
I don't feel terribly safe, and I'm not sure that these pay announcements are really going to make us safer, and I'm not actually sure that was the point.
Oh, all right. Well, help me out. What was the point then? Because that's pretty much what everybody was saying.
I think this is about moving executive, the set point on executive compensation, especially in the financial sector, but also across the economy. I think this is about moving the set point down.
By set point, you mean lowering the bar? Everybody's going to be making less?
I think that the level of acceptability for executive compensation rose over time.
Uh-huh.
And what Obama and the Federal Reserve is doing is they're trying to move it down. It's less a matter of law and more a matter of public and shareholder perception.
Lee, what we have here is a very high-profile, politically sensitive issue, this whole issue of compensation on Wall Street. Riddle me this, though. Was this the right target? Of all the things that they could have taken a really good whack at, should this have been the one?
Well, I think this is part of the puzzle. I mean, I do think that one of the things that got out of hand that led us to this crisis is that people were rewarded for taking short-term risk, and that's a very big thing, and that is exactly what this is designed, in theory, to rein in. So I do think that it's aiming at that. What's interesting is that this came out with a big splash this week, but we still don't know where we are in the other regulatory reforms that have taken a lot longer, I think, than anybody thought. And there's concern there that maybe we've missed the moment. But I do think that this is pretty targeted. The question is, will it work and will it have lasting implications?
Well, let's remind folks of what some of those other regulations were supposed to be. They're talking about controlling derivatives. They're talking about Consumer Financial Protection Agency. And then this is the one that gets the first bite at the apple, Mike.
I think this is – let me actually say two things. One is I don't think this is addressed towards the financial system as it is towards another problem, which is very large and growing inequality between the very top of the workforce and everybody else. And that you, in terms of political cohesion, you can have an economy where most people are suffering and then there's a few people who are doing really, really prominently well. I don't think they had a – choice about doing this. I think this is about maintaining the support for the bailouts, you know, building the support for the next bailout if it's needed. From a political point of view, this is absolutely essential. I go back and I look at what Ronald Reagan did in the early 1980s when he broke the air controller strike. Mm-hmm. And in that case, he was just focused on one union, but it had a wider political effect. I think what they're doing here is something that could have a broader effect, even though it's just focused on a relatively few number of institutions.
Lee, what do you think of that theory, that there's a more macro goal here?
I agree with Mike, and I think there's no way it won't have that impact. I mean, if you look at just the sort of publicity alone, the bailout politics here are at play more than anything else. I mean, there's real populist ire against Wall Street and against pay in particular. The problem is a lot of that ire is actually directed right now to Goldman Sachs, which has done so well in the past couple months and which stands to pay bonuses, you know, that are going to be extremely high this year. And having paid back their bailout money, of course, they are not part of the initial plan of Feinberg's to regulate the seven banks that took the bailout money.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Mike Mandel at Business Week. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 1% today, 109 points, closed at 9,972. The NASDAQ slipped 0.5%, 10 points, ended the day and the week at 2,154. The S&P 500 stumbled 1.2%, 13 points, met the bell today at 1,079. For the week, the Dow fell 0.2%, the NASDAQ fell 0.1%, the S&P 500 shed 0.7%. Railroad operators said they aren't expecting a first-class performance from the economy anytime soon. Union Pacific shunted down 5%. Burlington National unloaded 6.5% today after both companies issued gloomy forecasts. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 3.49%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 7 million K-12 students are enrolled in school districts that use software from SunGard Public Sector. More information at SunGard.com. And by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. President Obama is scheduled to talk to troops at Naval Air Station Jacksonville during a trip to Florida. The Obesity Society continues its 27th annual scientific meeting in Washington. And it was the start of the franchise, placing Sarah Connor in jeopardy in the past, present, and future, depending on how you look at it. The Terminator opened on October 26, 1984. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Tokyo Auto Show opens tomorrow. The media is already cooing about all the hybrid Hondas and plug-in Priuses that'll be there. But the recession has led some manufacturers to pull out, including Hyundai, one of the biggest automakers in the world. In fact, it sells more cars here than Chrysler does. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth how Hyundai did it and what the Detroit 3 might learn.
For a lot of people, Hyundai is still synonymous with joke. As in, have you heard the one about what's on page 4 of the Hyundai Owner's Manual? A bus schedule! But Tom Keiss thinks the joke's on them. He bought his first Hyundai, an SUV, in 2005.
It fit our needs, and I was able to get it within the price that I could afford to pay every month and still be comfortable with my bills. But this is nice because it's got enough room for the two kids and my wife and I and stuff from the grocery store, too.
He's bought two more Hyundais since then. And the salesman loves him.
Oh, yeah, I get calls on my birthday.
Keiss isn't the only one who thinks Hyundai's lousy reputation is 25 years out of date. It's true, the company did have serious quality problems when it first came to North America in the 80s. But so far this year, Hyundai's the fourth largest car company in the world. John Paul McDuffie runs the International Motor Vehicle Program at Wharton, and he says Hyundai's first big success was the way it remade its products.
They really were focused on thinking that they needed better products, a fuller product line, maybe styling that would appeal to export markets much more.
But after that, Hyundai still had to convince customers to give its vehicles another try. In 1999, Hyundai made American drivers a great offer, a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. Most companies were offering 3 years or 30,000 miles. McDuffie says the message was clear.
Here's why you don't have to worry about us. Here's a reason to overcome your past perceptions of us.
And it worked. Americans started buying Hyundais again. The company pulled off another marketing coup last winter. When nobody was buying cars because of the recession, they managed to get customers into their showrooms. This is the spot that ran during the Super Bowl. It introduced the new Hyundai Assurance Plan.
Now finance or lease any new Hyundai. And if you lose your income in the next year, you can return it with no impact on your credit.
They hit the timing just right with this, and they hit on a sentiment that really resonated with the marketplace.
David Stokols is CEO of Automotive Marketing Consultants.
And it brought Hyundai forward as an innovator and someone that was addressing the needs at the time.
And that's a tall order for any car maker right now. So could GM, Ford, or Chrysler possibly pull off what Hyundai did? David Stokols thinks they could.
You have to get to a place and time, whether it be through skill, timing, or luck, that you get people to look at your product and willing to accept it that way.
He says the Detroit 3 have been introducing some pretty nice cars, and they're trying to convince skeptical customers with some fancy ad campaigns. Something better work soon. David Letterman's already making jokes about tipping cab drivers with 100 shares of GM stock. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The big public policy issue this fall, and when I say big, I mean big like global big, is climate change, mostly because of a United Nations meeting in Copenhagen this December. In the run-up to that conference, environmental groups are trying to rally people to their cause. An organization called 350.org is sponsoring an international day of climate action tomorrow. People all over the world are going to be rallying to stop global warming with things like bike rides and human pyramids. 350.org was founded by Bill McKibben. His first book, 20 years ago, called The End of Nature, was really the first book written about climate change for the non-scientists among us. And when we talked, I asked him what that number, 350, is all about.
350 is the most important number in the world, even though really nobody knew it was important 2 years ago. Once The Arctic had melted in the summer of 2007. Our climate scientists went back to work, and they said this is happening faster than we thought, and the reason is that the climate is more sensitive than we thought. As one NASA study put it in January of 2008, any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Now, that's strong language,
wow, yeah.
And it's stronger still when you know that we're at 390 parts per million now. We're too high.
But I have to ask, how do we get back to 350? We're at 390-something now. How do you turn the clock back?
We've got to do everything we can as fast as we can. There are, unfortunately, no silver bullets, no technology that replaces fossil fuel one for one. It was good stuff. It's too bad it's wrecking the planet. Happily, there are some options that are becoming more and more possible all the time. When I talked about solar power or wind power 20 years ago, frankly, we had our fingers crossed. Not so anymore. Wind power is the fastest growing source of electric generation around the world, and it could grow much faster if our governments put us on the kind of wartime footing we need to be on.
All of this comes with a price tag, though. The latest figures I see show something like 1 to 3% of global gross domestic product, like $1 trillion or more.
That's right. There's no free lunch here, and I'm not going to pretend that there is. There have been three or four really good studies now of what it would take to get back to 350, and they all show some cost. On the other side of the ledger, the cost of not doing anything is so astonishing that it hardly even bears talking about. You can't have an economy on a planet that's broken.
On the subject of October the 24th, Saturday, and your planetary call to action, it seems a rather grand ambition for a movement that has had trouble galvanizing global agreement on what to do about climate change in the first place.
It is, and takes me by surprise that our piece of this movement has managed to go as viral as it has. I think what it speaks to is the desire of a great many people to finally insist that our leaders pay some attention to the science. We need a movement. That's the movement we've been building. It's incredibly exciting to see it happening everywhere, along the shores of the dwindling Dead Sea. You know, the Israeli activists are making a giant human 3 on their beach, and the Palestinians a giant human 5 on theirs, and the Jordanians a giant 0. Almost making the case that we're going to have to put aside some of our other differences for a while and deal with the single biggest problem we've ever faced.
Bill McKibben, he's the coordinator of 350.org. That's a climate change campaign. Bill, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you so much. Have a good day.
This is going to sound like blasphemy to devotees of Jay Leno, but NBC didn't put him in primetime 5 nights a week because it thinks he's the next best thing since must-see TV. He got all that real estate because an hour of his show is way cheaper to put on the air than, say, an hour of Law & Order. If he did well, all the costs the network saved would mean a big boost in profits. Only hasn't played out that way. Leno's ratings are falling by the week. And yesterday, the head of NBC television admitted what analysts have known for a while now, that trying to set a schedule with an eye on the bottom line doesn't really work. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
NBC says it's no longer going to program shows specifically to save money. At the same time, the network says it's not worried about the Leno ratings and that it wasn't expecting the kinds of ratings that would go with a hit drama. But Jeff Jarvis of CUNY Journalism School says this is an experiment that isn't working.
At the 10 o'clock hour, yes, it's much cheaper to produce with Leno, but the show is, pardon me, I'm an old TV critic, it's treacle, it's boring. It's the worst of primetime, and it puts me asleep before 11 o'clock every time I try to watch it.
Apparently it's putting others to sleep too. Lots of local TV stations are complaining that Leno isn't delivering a big enough audience to the 11 o'clock news, typically a big profit source for them. But Ben Grossman of Broadcasting and Cable says NBC's shift in strategy is not a reaction to Leno's ratings. He says the network has realized it needs to invest in high-profile dramas and comedies.
They've got shows like 30 Rock and The Office that are critically acclaimed and win Emmys, but they don't do big, broad audience numbers that you can use as currency with advertisers. That's the problem. NBC simply has to come up with one or two new hits, and they need to do it soon.
Even if they succeed, Jeff Jarvis says it's riskier than ever before to spend that cash. He says so many younger viewers are moving away from TV to the internet, and they're not the only ones.
The audience is going elsewhere, the talent is going elsewhere, and the ad dollars are going elsewhere. So the TV networks are shrinking, but the only way they know how to make money is by producing blockbusters.
While NBC mulls its programming, its future hangs in the balance. Its parent company may be about to sell a controlling stake to cable company Comcast. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note this Friday afternoon, a break from the headlines, a chance to hear, courtesy of Brendan Noonan and Rico Galliano and the Marketplace staff, about the news that didn't make it on the radio.
Scott Jigow, Marketplace blogger and host of the After the Bell podcast. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Wired magazine had a great story that the CIA is sinking millions of dollars into a company that tracks blogs and other social network sites on the web.
And that's not anything that I should be afraid of, right?
Well, I don't know. I think they're really trying to target foreign social networks to keep tabs on terrorists, but...
So the lesson is, if you're a terrorist, don't Twitter about it.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace, what's your story?
Bank of America and Citigroup are going to start charging people for being good.
It was only a matter of time.
I know. So Bank of America is going to start charging people who pay off their credit card balances every month.
What?
I know. And Citigroup is going to start charging people who don't spend enough on their credit cards.
And next comes the help an old lady across the street fee and the daily breathing toll.
Yes.
And of course, the banks won't be subject to these fees because they're not in danger of paying back the government on time.
Rada Beed, senior producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, I love this. Guy in Massachusetts goes to a Honda dealer, wants to test drive a new Honda. Salesman gets in with him. 1,000 miles later, they catch the guy in Wisconsin. He took it on a 1,000-mile test drive.
He just wanted to be sure that the brakes were really reliable.
You got a lot of things to check out. You got to get the seat just right, but you got the radio.
Exactly. And if this guy goes back to buy the car, he'll get a discount because there's 1,000 miles on the thing.
That is just a quick taste of what Brendan and Rico can do. Their full talents are on display in their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download, and there is a link to it on our website, marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace, the radio program from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 109 points. That's 1%. The NASDAQ down 10 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 off 13 points, 1.2%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer is J.J. Ewell. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, when a parent loses a job, the kids want to be understanding, but it's not always easy.
I'm actually a little upset about it just because I hear about all my friends who have their parents who have saved since the time they were two, and it feels like that's a parent's job.
That's this weekend. Marketplace is back Monday, same time, same channel. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you then.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like...
What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.